back home again.
And
Shabbat Shalom to those who will be watching with us today. We are almost live, a little bit of a delay we have, but we will be going online here in a few hours, so we have the opportunity of sharing this fellowship with our brethren around the world. The message I want to give today, it's called, Are You Fulfilling Your Priesthood? Are you fulfilling your priesthood? And we were just going over in our Torah reading, Numbers, the third chapter, which I think was a good chapter to talk about before we start getting into the message. Because like I was saying, as we're going to see here from Exodus 19, that originally Yahweh had made Israel with the intention Israel is his firstborn. And we know in the Bible, first fruits and firstborn are interchangeable. And he had planned for Aaron to be set apart for the high priesthood, you know, a shadow of the high priesthood of Melchizedek, and then the rest of the tribes of Israel, each man would be family head of his family, and they would be a kingdom of priests that would be working. But we know after the golden calf incident that changed, and Levi took over the position as the servants in the tabernacle instead of the sons of Israel. But where we're going to see here, and in the purpose of man, I go into this, the second Adam redeeming the things that the first Adam lost. And part of that redemption was the everlasting Melchizedek priesthood from the Garden of Eden. And also the priesthood of the New Testament believers, you know, of getting back into being a kingdom of priests to Yahweh, as we'll see here today. And then I want to go into basically three aspects of priests. So we had a message a little bit ago for the ladies, being a woman like Sarah of old. And today it's going to be more for the men. It's more for the headship of a man and his family as priests. And like I said, the three biblical aspects of that. Because I do hear men sometimes talk about this and say it. But again, it's got to be under the guise of what Scripture says. And one of the things I like about reading what we just did in Numbers 3, and there's other scriptures that also talk about it. Like Eric was saying, we see that there's an order to everything. You know, there's got to be a biblical order that Yahweh set out a certain order, and there's certain things you must do to fulfill your priesthood. And if you don't do it, you're not going to be fulfilling your priesthood. So it's not just something randomly that you can just do any way you want to or take it any way you want to, but Yahweh has an order for everything. So I want to start in Genesis 2. Genesis, the second chapter, starting in verse 5, because I want to show Adam being the first priest, having the first opportunity of priesthood. And like I was saying, what's very interesting is, you know, when you look at modern Judaism, and as I was mentioning, that Judaism believes, you know, when you look at Adam and Eve and Noah and these stories, that they're analogies, you know, and maybe they're not even real people and they're just stories to be made up. Yet the funny part is then when you get to the book of Genesis that does have analogies in there, then all of a sudden they're taking it all literal. You know, that Yahweh is doing this unbelievable creation. He's creating billions of stars and atmosphere and universe and galaxies and all these things so that one guy can plant tomatoes. You know, it is illogical. It makes no sense. You know, so where clearly Yahweh is using analogies to point toward what his plan is, they're missing it. And then where he's physically using real people to do it, they're missing that. So they're missing the boat on both ends. But when we look at Genesis 2 and verse 5, and he says, and every shrub of the field was not yet on the earth, and every plant of the field had not yet sprung up, for Yahweh Elohim had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one from mankind to till the ground. Yahweh Elohim had not sent rain on the earth. And like we so eloquently learned when we had our class on the calendar, and the calendar goes by the cyclical cycle. And like we said, we know here in Israel, there's 7 months where you get not a drop of rain. And that's why it's extremely important when you're looking at the growing cycle, you know, that we just finished now the planting cycle. We're really in, could be in the late planting. There is some late planting that gets done in December. But late October, November is really the planting cycle. Beginning of December, the late planting cycle. And then, of course, you have the rainy season. The rainy season is upon us. It comes from about the middle of December through the end of February. And before that, you have the early rain and you have the latter rain. So when Yahweh is here saying, Yahweh Elohim had not sent rain on the earth, you know, what is he saying? He's saying that the early rain and the latter rain, we know the early rain that came with the apostles and the early believers, and then there's a latter rain in the end time. And clearly when we see these terms in Scripture, we see that they're dedicated to harvests of people, not harvests of fruit. So the early rain, when Yahweh is prophetically talking about the early rain and the latter rain, he's talking about it with people. He's talking about it with harvesting people, with bearing fruit. So here where he says he had not sent rain on the earth because there was no man or no one from mankind to till the ground, he's saying there is no early rain and latter rain because there's nobody there. What's the purpose of it? What would be the purpose for Yahweh to bless an early rain, the latter rain, if there's nobody to bring the message? We know this comes from Romans 10 and verse 15, verse 13 through 15. You know, how can they hear unless somebody be sent? And how can they be sent? Blessed are the feet of them bringing the good news of peace. So at this point now, there's nobody to do it. He doesn't have anybody to do it. So what does he do in verse 8? And Yahweh Elohim planted a garden in Eden to the east, and he put the man, Ha-Adam, Adam, whom he formed there. So he takes Ha-Adam, the man, and he puts him in this garden here. So now he has somebody. Now he has a priest. Now he has somebody who is going to be able to be trained, to be able to bear the fruit. Now he can give the early rain and the latter rain. And then verse 15, and Yahweh Elohim took Ha-Adam, the man, and put him into the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. To work it and to keep it. And like I was saying, that word keep it literally means to guard and protect it. He's guarding and protecting. And we know from the parable of the sower and the seed, Yeshua clearly says the seed is the word of Yahweh. So if the seed is the word of Yahweh, and Yahweh doesn't change, then we see here in Genesis, when he's talking about seed, the seed is the word of Yahweh, he told us. That's the way you have to read your Bible. You don't put private interpretation. You put line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. So you take one scripture to interpret another scripture. So here it is. Adam, what is Adam guarding? Is he guarding the tomatoes? Is he guarding the cucumbers? No, he's guarding the word of Yahweh. And when you see Abraham get the covenant reinstituted through him, it's the same thing. Genesis 26 and verse 5. Why did Yahweh bless Abraham? Because Abraham kept, he guarded and protected, the same word, his laws, his statutes, his Torah. So that's what the job was. And why would he have to guard and protect it? Because man is only going to live so many years. And he's going to have a child. And his child has to follow in the footsteps, to follow in the footsteps, to follow in the footsteps. Or the word will not be guarded and protected. So Yahweh Elohim took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. And like we said, the word also means to work, to worship. One of the meanings of that word is also to worship. So again, in this priesthood in the Garden of Eden, in the Melchizedek priesthood, which is in eternal order, not going to go into that today, we have other messages. We know from many other scriptures, Psalm 110, which I will read later, it is in order and in eternal order. So it's here in the Garden of Eden. We definitely see it by Genesis 14. We see Melchizedek himself appearing before Abraham. So again, it's an eternal order, and it's an order of worship, not an order of sacrificing of animals. And we said this, when you look at the word korban, it literally is drawing closer to through relationship. The idea of killing animals to get closer toward your Creator only came when sin entered. Before there was sin, we see nothing even remotely that would ever make us think that anything dealing with killing or shedding of blood is something that is going to be draw you closer to your Creator. Only when sin came into the picture, and we know because of sin, the Lamb of Yahweh was slain from the foundation of the world, that now the template was, so to speak, set out, and that template was that sin sheds innocent blood. So how would Yahweh redeem mankind back to him? Through the shedding of innocent blood, through the shedding of his Son. So Adam's the first priest here. He's working the garden here, he's put in there, and he's over here to worship Yahweh. Then you go in Genesis 3. Genesis 3 and Genesis 3. So when you're thinking of you men, are you fulfilling your priesthood? Be thinking of what I'm saying here, because we're setting the precedent. You always want to go, precedents are set from the beginning, you know, not from later on. The precedent is set from the beginning, so what we're learning in the beginning is going to help us to understand. And then Genesis 3, the serpent was cunning above every beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made. And he said to the woman, is it so that Elohim had said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden? And interesting enough, we talked about this before, the chapter breaks are put in there by man. Originally, if you take the original Torah, not only isn't there chapter breaks, there's no letter breaks. It says letters, all letters in. You know, thousands and thousands of letters. And then you have to separate where the words are separated. So these chapter breaks and these other things were put in much, much later. So when you look at verse 25 of chapter 2, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. And now naked, interesting enough, is showing what? It's showing purity. It's showing purity with Yahweh, innocence. You know, like when a little child is two or three and they're running around naked, they don't know any better. There's an innocence there. There's a purity. But the interesting part is, the very next verse says, and the serpent was cunning. Do you know they come from the same root word? Cunning and naked come from the same root. So we're seeing that where Adam and Eve were innocent, they were pure before Yahweh, the serpent was cunning. So it's a play on words showing that he's going to take that innocence away from them. The innocence that Yahweh gave them through obedience. And that's all innocence is blind faith. I shouldn't say blind faith, it's faith. It's not blind because Yahweh is, and Yahweh's perfect. So we don't have to be blind to agree with that and obey it. We simply have to be smart, you know, or innocent. But the serpent was cunning above every beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made. And he said to the woman, is it so that Elohim had said you shall not eat from any tree of the garden? Interesting, doing a study, I was trying to see if there's ever any time in Scripture where Satan ever addressed Yahweh by his name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and I haven't been able to find it. Whenever it's there, he's usually just saying Elohim. And the woman said to the serpent, of the fruit of the tree of the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, Elohim had said, you shall not eat of it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, surely you shall not die. For Elohim knows that in the day you eat of it, even your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as Elohim, knowing good and evil. So, I'm going to stop there in the story. And my first question, though, is, we already established in chapter 2 that Adam was the first priest. Yahweh had a garden here. He had the seed, the word of Yahweh, which we know from the parable of the sower and the seed. He picked a man from humanity to come into this garden, which is the presence of Yahweh, and to protect and to guard, as it says here, the word of Yahweh. And now, all of a sudden, the serpent's showing up. The serpent is deceiving the innocents. And my question is, where is the priest? Where is the priest? You know, where is the priest? So when we're looking at men, are you fulfilling your priesthood? The first question we come up with here, because we're going to see the ramifications of this story affect every human being for the rest of history. Where is Adam, the priest of the family, and the priest of the sanctuary of Yahweh at that point? Where is he? Where is he when here the serpent is coming? Where is he protecting his priesthood? Where is he protecting his family? Where is he protecting the garden? How did the serpent even get into the garden if Adam was protecting it? So now let's go to verse 9. And Yahweh Elohim called to the man, Ha'adom, and said to him, where are you? Where are you? It reminds me of Eliyahu, remember? When he's supposed to be over there fighting the priests of Baal, and he wins the battle, and all the people are saying, Yahweh is Elohim. And all of a sudden, what happens next? He's afraid of Jezebel. He goes running to Mount Horeb, huffing and puffing. And what does Yahweh say? What are you doing here? You know, what on earth are you doing here? You had a job to do. And that's what Yahweh says here. Where are you? Where are you? You know? It's the heat of the day. You're supposed to be working in the garden, protecting it. You know, you're the priest of the family. Where are you? And my question here also to the men. Men, where are you? Where are you, men? Are you the priest of your family? You know, when a situation comes up, are you right away blaming your wife or blaming the neighbor or blaming someone else? You know, when you're the priest of the family. And like the old adage, the buck stops here. The buck stops here. Because when it comes to Yahweh, when Yahweh comes and he sees there's a problem here, who's the first one he's coming to? Adam. Adam's the priest of the family. And that's what I say. A man and a woman are united and they make decisions together. It's not this caveman type mentality that you're going to pull your wife by the hair, club her over the head and say, woman, you follow me. You make your decisions together. But at the end of the day, the man is the one responsible to Yahweh. And it's got to be known that way in the family. And he may take his wife's advice 90% of the time because maybe his wife is smarter than him. So there's nothing wrong with taking the advice of our spouse. That's wisdom. You know, I said this, always said this, talked about this when we were talking about leadership. You know, and George Bush. I personally don't think George Bush is the brightest man in the world. And it's not a knock. I like George Bush. Seems like he had a good personality. But what I liked about him was he realized his limitations, and when he became president, he put people around him who were smart. And he listened to them, because they were smarter than him. So a man doesn't have to feel inability because his wife may be able to do something better than him. You know, that's only smartness. But in the end of the day, when a decision is made, it's the man who has the responsibility before Yahweh. And that's what's happening here. Yahweh is coming and saying, Adam, where are you? And let's look what Adam says. And he said, I have heard your sound in the garden. I was afraid, for I am naked, and I hid myself. And he said, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree, which I commanded you not to eat? And the man, Ha'adom, Adam, said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she has given to me to eat of the tree, and I ate. Woe is Adam, right? So now he's adding insult to injury. First, he abdicates his position. He gives it over to Satan. He lets his family get defiled. And then when Yahweh rightly comes and he's looking for the leader of the family and saying, where are you? What is he saying? This woman you gave to me, she made me eat it. Was he sucking his thumb as he was saying it? I don't know, maybe. But again, it reminds us back to the Jezebel story. You know, who's stronger? Who's stronger? And I say that you cannot have a Jezebel unless you have an Ahab. You can't have a Jezebel unless you have an Ahab. A man has to abdicate his position in order for a woman to take control of it. It's that simple. You know, so here in this situation, it's a really, really telling story of Adam abdicating his role as priest and his wife, his children, and humanity paid dearly ever since. You know, so if Adam was holding the ground, so to speak, if he was holding the fort down, if he was being the priest of his family, we would all be in a different situation right now. So another thing we learned from this story is, as men, the buck stops here. You know, in the end of the day, yes, should we take advice from our wife? Absolutely. Should we take advice from the congregation and other people? Absolutely. But in the end of the day, the decision that's made as the leader of the family, we're responsible before Yahweh. And Yahweh is going to come to us, and he's going to want to know why we did a certain thing. So that's why I think it's prudent, if we don't know something, to take advice from other people. All over the Bible it talks about, in the council of many counselors, their safety. You know, so it's a prudent thing. But again, in this situation, Adam had to abdicate his position in order for Satan to take over. And that's literally what he did. He was put there. It says nothing about Eve being put in the garden. Adam's put in the garden. Adam, in verse 15 of chapter 2 again, Yahweh Elohim took Ha'adom, the man, and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. Adam was given the position of authority, and Adam blew it. It's that simple. When the devil, when the serpent came in chapter 3, Adam is not protecting what's his. He's not protecting what he was put over. Then in verse 16, and he, Yahweh, said to the woman, I will greatly increase your sorrow and your conception. You shall bear sons in sorrow, and your desire shall be toward your husband, and he will rule over you. So very simple. We see this from Numbers, the 30th chapter, the same thing. A woman should always have headship. In this day and age, I know that probably if I was back in Babylon, I'd be getting stoned with tomatoes now, or maybe rocks. People are pretty vile these days, because that sounds real male chauvinist and everything else. But it's for protection, as we see here. That if Eve actually had the protection of her priest, there wouldn't have been a problem. So again, we know that a girl who's growing up, if she has a believing father, should be under the authority of her father until she gets married. If she has a believing husband, then she should be under the authority of her believing husband. If she doesn't have a believing husband, a believing father, then she should be under the authority of the elders in the congregation. The same if somebody is a widow or whatever. But a woman should always have headship. A woman should always have headship. And if we see one thing from here, we see that when a woman does not have headship, there's going to be trouble. You see it throughout the whole Bible. You know, and we see for men, when men abdicate their position and when they're not being led by Elohim and taking it, they're going to have trouble. So it's on both sides. And the point of it is, each of us has been given a role. But the man has been given the role of the priest in the family. It's that simple. And if the man does not fulfill that role, then he has no one to blame but himself for the outcome. So that's what we learn here. And then verse 17, let's look at Adam. And he said to the man, Ha-Adom, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it. The ground shall be cursed because of you. You shall eat of it in sorrow all the days of your life. The ground shall be cursed. So here we see, you know, the ground shall be cursed. You look again, the parable of the sower and the seed. And we know that the ground is what's producing the fruit. So now he's saying, whereas before it would have been pretty easy, Adam, without sin in the world, just like in the kingdom, our job's going to be easy. When the kingdom comes, Isaiah 65, Isaiah 66, we are going to go to the four corners of the earth. And there's going to be millions of people who didn't die in the tribulation. And we're going to teach them. And they're going to have hearts to understand. And they're not going to seek war anymore. They're going to turn their swords into plowshares. And they're going to listen to the message. And this would have happened if Adam didn't abdicate his position. He would have had much greater fertile ground to harvest. But because he didn't, because he abdicated now, and now he allowed Satan to become the Elohim of this world, what do you think is going to happen in Satan's world? You're going to have problems. You're going to have problems in the family. You're going to have problems in your marriage. You're going to have problems with your kids. And you're going to have problems with bearing fruit for the kingdom. It's that simple. So this changes everything. It changes everything from this point. But still, it was not Yahweh's will. It wasn't Yahweh's will from the beginning. Exodus 19. We see when Yahweh takes Exodus, when he takes Israel out in the book of Exodus, out of Egypt. Physically out of the land of Egypt, and also spiritually Egypt being related to our sinful old lifestyle. Exodus 19 and verse 3. He says, and Moses went up to Elohim, and Yahweh called to him from the mountain, saying, you shall say this to the house of Jacob, and tell it to the sons of Israel. You have seen what I did in Egypt, and I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to me. And now, if listening, you will listen to my voice, and you will keep my covenant, you shall become a special treasure to me above all the nations, for all the earth is mine. And you shall become a kingdom of priests for me, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So we see that this was Yahweh's will, but what happens? Like we said, as Moses is going up to get the Ten Commandments, the Israelites build a golden calf. They, again, violate themselves completely, defile themselves completely, and then Yahweh says, no, this ain't going to work. You're not anymore going to be servants to me in the sanctuary. The tribe of Levi, who did not get involved with the golden calf, you will take their place now. You are going to replace the firstborn. And we know from Exodus 3, Israel is Yahweh's firstborn. But now Levi is going to, they're going to be a prototype for that. At least until the new covenant comes. But now we're in the new covenant. So what do we see? We see the exact same thing in 1 Peter 2:9. As we read here in Exodus 19. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. But you are an elect race, a royal priesthood, a holy people, and a people for possession, that you should proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness to his precious light. So we see now the pattern can start to be completed that wasn't completed in the first covenant. And this is why I thought it was really apropos to read our Torah reading, which we read today. Because like I said, where Aaron was typical of the Melchizedek priesthood and doing the priestly duties, we'll see in the New Covenant, we still have an elderhood. We still have people that were hands laid on the way Aaron laid hands on his children. But instead of where Levi now had to represent all of Israel, in the New Covenant, it's not that way. In the New Covenant now, all of us can be like the Levites. We can be training in that priesthood. And of course, we know when the kingdom comes, we will. Every first fruit believer will be a king and a priest in the kingdom of Yahweh. So Yahweh wants us. He doesn't want us to focus on how Adam failed. He doesn't want us to focus on how the sons of Israel failed and Levi had it to go for. He wants us to focus on our potential now. So this is why I want to go over the rest of the message. Three aspects of being a priest to Yahweh. Three aspects of your priestly duty, let's say. Of your priestly duty. And again, we are all priests in training for the kingdom. But within judicial order, as we just read, the man is still the priest of his family. At least he should be. You know, keeping the judicial order in training in the family. So there's three aspects, though, if you're going to be a priest of Yahweh. The first one is, a priest is a teacher of the Torah. A priest is a teacher of the Torah. Malachi 2 and verse 7. Malachi 2 and verse 7 says, "For the lips of the priest should guard knowledge, and they should seek the Torah from his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of hosts." And didn't we read that about Adam in Genesis 2? He was to guard and protect the garden, guard and protect the seed, guard and protect the word of Yahweh, which he failed to. So we see here, Malachi, "For the lips of the priest should guard knowledge, and they should seek the Torah from his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of hosts." So as priests of your family, men, you need to be able to be teaching your family from the Torah. Deuteronomy 6 in verse 6. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 6. He says, "And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall diligently teach them to your sons, and you shall speak of them as you sit in the house, and as you walk in the way, and as you're lying down, and as you're rising up. And you shall bind them for a sign in your hand, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes." So again, the priest of the family, his job is to be training his children, teaching his children, teaching them the Torah. From the time they get up, the time they're going on the way, the time they're going to sleep. Ezra 7, Ezra the 7th chapter, in verse 6. It says, "This Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a skilled scribe in the Torah of Moses, which Yahweh the Elohim of Israel has given, and the king granted him all he asked according to the hand of Yahweh his Elohim on him." He was a skilled scribe in the Torah of Moses, Ezra the priest. Go down to verse 10. "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the Torah of Yahweh and to do it, and to teach statutes and judgments in Israel." Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the Torah of Yahweh and to do it and to teach statutes and judgments in Israel. One way to learn the Torah is by doing the Torah. It's by living it, by doing it. Verse 25, we see the same thing. "And you, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your Eloi in your hand, you appoint judges and magistrates who may judge all the people who are beyond the river and who know the laws of your Eloi. And those who do not know, you cause to know." So this is the job of the priest. The ones who don't know, you cause them to know. You teach them, you train them. You know, part of the job of the priesthood. So again, sometimes in families where you see that there's problems in the family, and you see the children are going out, what's happening? If the children are going to the world, then the priest of the family, the head of the family, the father is not fulfilling his job of teaching them correctly. That's part of the job of the head of the family, the priest. Nehemiah 8. Nehemiah 8, we'll see the same thing, starting in verse 1. "And all the people gathered as one man into the plaza of the sanctuary before the water gate. And they spoke to Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the Torah of Moses, which Yahweh had commanded to Israel.
And Ezra the priest brought the Torah before the congregation, both of men and women and all that could hear and understand, on the first day of the seventh month. And he read in it before the wide sanctuary plaza, before the water gate, from the morning until noon, before the men and the women and those who could understand. And all the ears of all the people listened to the book of the Torah.
So again, we see Ezra here teaching the people according to his job in verse 8.
And they read aloud clearly in the book, in the Torah of the Elohim, and they gave the sense and caused them to discern the reading.
So again, the priest of the family, he's got to be able to teach the family, he's got to be able to discern truth from error.
In 2 Timothy 2:15, 2 Timothy 2:15 says, "And study to present yourself approved to Elohim, a workman unashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth."
Rightly dividing the word of truth. So, first rule here, if any man who's a priest of his family is not studying the word every day, then you have a problem. You're not fulfilling your priesthood. And you'll never fulfill your priesthood. You must be studying the word every single day. Very clearly. If you're going to be a priest of the Torah. And remember, like we said before, relationships. You know, when we talked about marriage, we talked about the marriage covenant. Some of us are married, some of us are widowed, some of us are divorced, some of us are single. But it doesn't make a difference. We are all part of the same marriage covenant. So the whole point of the covenant is to see how faithful we'll be to Yeshua. So whether you're single, or whether you're married, or whether you're divorced, or whether you're widowed, each of us may be in a different spot in life, but we all have to show him the same loyalty, the same integrity. You know, that's what it is. So we may have a different test, but we're all going after the same reward. You know, we're all going to be part somehow or another of the Bride of Messiah. Whether that's an extended part or an inner part, that's up to him. But the point is, each of us have to show that faithfulness. And marriage is only a test. So it's the same thing here. As training to be priests, it's a test. And when the kingdom comes, every first fruit will be a king and a priest. That's what it says. Revelation 20, 4 through 6. So we need to make sure that we're taking it serious. You know, whether we're the wives or the ones that are under subjection, helping our husband complete his role as a priest, fulfilling where he is lacking, not nagging him where he's not. You know, that's part of the job. And the man, that the man needs to be nurturing the environment for his family. He needs to be training his family. He needs to be nurturing his children in the word. And of course, if he's not doing it himself, you know, then there's no way he's ever going to be able to do it. So first rule of the priest is a teacher of the Torah. Number two, second aspect of a priest is a priest must be sanctified. A priest must be sanctified. He must be set apart to Yahweh. Let's go to Exodus 19. Exodus 19 and verse 22. "And also the priests, those approaching Yahweh, let them sanctify themselves, that Yahweh not burst forth among them." And we know that word for set apart or sanctify, kadosh. In English we say holy sometimes. It's something that is separated from the world. You know, you're not going to be a priest of your family, and you're certainly not going to be a priest of Yahweh if you're not separated from the world. And what I see all too often today, that people in the covenant, people that are immersed, you know, Sabbath keepers, instead of being a priest of the Torah, they're a priest of the internet. You know, and most of their job is time is not reading the word of Yahweh, it's surfing the internet. And if you're surfing the internet, you're also going to fail on number two. You're not going to be sanctified to Yahweh. So again, there's a time for the internet. There's a time, and like I say, how much time before the internet came that you used to go to a library and research things? That's about how much time you should be spending on the internet. Or if you're writing a letter to someone, how much time you're writing a letter is the same thing. But spending hours upon hours, unending hours of just surfing stuff on the internet, you're taking away your sanctification from Yahweh. Exodus 28. Exodus 28 and verse 36. Says, "And you shall make a plate of pure gold, and you shall engrave on it the engravings of a signet, holiness to Yahweh."
the priest would wear this, set apart to Yahweh. They would literally wear a plate of pure gold on their head that says, set apart or holiness to Yahweh. So point two, the priest must be sanctified. Chapter 29, the very next chapter, verse 4. And you shall take Aaron and his sons to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and you shall wash them in water. Baptism, right? How do we enter the covenant? We enter the covenant first through baptism. Drop down to verse 6. And you shall put the mitre on his head, and you shall put the holy crown on the mitre. And you shall take the oil of anointing, and shall pour in his head, and you shall anoint him. So again, what happens after we're baptized? We have the laying on of hands. So this is where a man, when he is being baptized, he's not simply just joining the covenant of Yahweh. He's being consecrated for his priesthood. His priesthood into his family. And then we go to verse 29 and 30. And the holy garments which are Aaron shall be his sons after him, for anointing in them and for filling their hands in them. The priest shall put them on 7 days, the one from his sons taking his place, the one who comes into the tabernacle of the congregation to minister in the sanctuary. And we know the armor of Yahweh in the book of Ephesians is the same thing that we put on every day. So we see first he's washed, then he's anointed, and then he's clothed. So we see the same thing in the new covenant. We see first we're baptized or immersed, then we're laid on hands for the Holy Spirit, and then we're clothed. We're clothed with the armor of Yahweh. So it's got to be the same thing. And that's what part of this sanctification is. It's putting on the armor of Yahweh every day. It's being set apart from the world. So that when there is a problem in your family, you can get on your hands and knees and you can pray and you can hear Yahweh's answer. So again, second point here is sanctification. Sanctification. Part of that sanctification is also being a mediator, as we'll see a priest is. Exodus 28, 29. We go back one chapter. Exodus 28 and verse 29. Says, and Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breast pocket of judgment, on his heart, in his going into the holy place, for a memorial before the face of Yahweh continuously. So Aaron was a type of mediator on behalf of all 12 tribes. When Aaron went in on the Day of Atonement, he was doing it as a mediator. He's doing the blood. First on behalf of himself, he'd have to kill the animal. Then on behalf of the tribes. Galatians 3 and verse 19. Galatians 3 and verse 19 says, why then the Levitical law? It was placed beside the Torah for the sake of transgressions, until the seed should come to whom it had been promised, being given by promise in a mediator's hand. The Levites were a mediator. They were a mediator between Yahweh and the people. If we go to Ephesians 6, Ephesians 6, we'll see that a man needs to mediate for his family through prayer. Of course, the one mediator for sin is Yeshua. There's one mediator between Yahweh and man, Yeshua Messiah. So a man is not mediating for his family for their sins. Even as a husband or a father, as the leader of the family, he can't save the life of his wife or his children. But he can mediate in the sense of prayer. That the priest of the family, the leader of the family, should be mediating in prayer. Ephesians 6 and verse 18. It says, through all prayer and petition, praying at all times in the Spirit, and watching to the same thing with all perseverance and petition concerning all the saints. So men, as priests of Yahweh, are we doing that? Are we being mediators? Are we being intercessory mediators in prayer on behalf of our family and even on behalf of the congregation? 1 Timothy 2. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 1. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 1. First of all then, he says, I exhort that petitions, prayers, supplication, and thanksgiving be made on behalf of all men. For kings and the ones being in high position, that we may lead a tranquil and quiet existence in all purity and holiness. Again, set apart. For this is good and acceptable before Elohim, our Savior. So again, the priest being the prayer, the intercessory prayer in his family, is sanctifying his family for peace and for the work of Yahweh. Then in verse 8, 1 Timothy 2:8, he says, therefore I desire the men to pray in every place, lifting up holy hands without anger and doubting thoughts. So it's a great responsibility. Because a leader in the family has to have patience. He has to be diligent. And he can't doubt. Because if the leader is doubting, the family is going to doubt. You know, the leader is to take those doubts away. The leader is to bring comfort to the family, the priest of the family. He's not to bring more doubts. So therefore, I desire the men to pray in every place, lifting up holy hands without anger and doubting thoughts. So men, as priests of our family, there is great power. There is great power in prayer. Jacob 5 and verse 16. Jacob 5 and verse 16 says, "Confess your faults one to another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man is powerful." The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man is powerful. And this is why he has to be sanctified. He has to be set apart. Because if he's not set apart, Yahweh will not hear his prayer. But if he is set apart, you know, if he is training his family according to the Torah, and he's setting apart his life as a priest to Yahweh for his family, then Yahweh will hear his prayer, and those prayers are powerful. And many things in families can change simply by that, by prayer. So prayer to a righteous priest of his family is powerful. 1 Peter 3. But we'll see if the leader of the family is not using this. 1 Peter 3 and verse 5. We'll see the problem that arises. "For so once indeed the holy women who were hoping on Elohim adorned themselves, submitting themselves to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him master, whose children you became, doing good and not being confused by false values. And you husbands likewise dwell with your wives according to knowledge, and hold them in honor as the weaker vessel, because they also will inherit with you the gifts of eternal life, and let not your prayers be hindered." And let not your prayers be hindered. The husband, honor the wife as the weaker vessel and protect them, or your prayers will be hindered. The wives, they'll have to uplift the husband. You know, like it says here, I know some women cringe when they read this. "Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him master, whose children you became." But like we read it, that comes back to from Genesis 3. The wife is there as the completer of the husband. Men are not perfect. We know that. So where the man is lacking, that's why we have a wife. And like I said, where men are not giving the conducive atmosphere for the wife to grow, you're only hurting yourself. You're only hurting yourself. Because as the wife grows, she'll complete you and you're both are going to be better. But if the wife is not showing reverence to the husband and simply attacking him over and over and over, then you're just going to have this almost like they say here, a circle of violence. A circle of violence that comes and goes. It's like Israel. Are they justified when bombs come of bombing back? Of course they are. But does it solve everything? No, it solves nothing. You have the same pattern. So now it's quiet for a little. What's going to happen again? Hamas will start sending missiles sooner or later. Israel will attack them again. And you have the same circle of violence. So again, if the wife is not giving the proper reverence to the husband, and then the husband is attacking the wife, you're just going to have a circle of violence in your family. And what is the end result? Your prayers are going to be hindered. It's not helping either party. Ephesians the fifth chapter, in verse 25. Ephesians 5 and verse 25. It says, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Messiah also loved the congregation and gave himself up on its behalf, that he might sanctify it." Again, like we said, the priest has to be sanctified if you're going to serve. "That he might sanctify it, cleansing it by the washing of the water of the word." Like we just said, the priest had to be washed, immersion, before he was able to serve. "That he might present it to himself as the glorious congregation, not having stain or wrinkle or any such things, but that it be wholly set apart and without blemish." So husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He loving his wife loves himself. "For then no one hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even also as our master does to the congregation. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this a man will leave his father and mother, and will be joined to his wife, and the two shall become ikat, united. This is a great mystery, but I speak as to Messiah and his congregation. Nevertheless, let every one of you so love his wife as himself, and the wife that she give reverence to the husband. Like I say, it's a two-way street. Judicial order, it's always voluntary and reciprocal. It's always voluntary and reciprocal. The husband is supposed to portray love that Messiah has for the congregation. And like I said, it's all a test. Your husband or your wife, whoever it is today, will not be that in the kingdom. All of us are striving for the perfect relationship with Yeshua. But neither are we perfect in this life, and neither are our mates going to be perfect. So we can't use that as an excuse. Like we said, when we go back to Genesis, we don't want to use the Adam excuse. Well, she gave it to me. It didn't work. It didn't work then, it doesn't work now. Each of us has to be responsible. The wife needs to be responsible for being under the judicial order and be subservient to helping complete her husband's faults. And the husband needs to be responsible for loving his wife and caring for his family and having them be sanctified to Yahweh. So men, are you nurturing your wife's talents and making an atmosphere that is conducive for her growth? Some men, due to pride, are threatened by a woman doing something better than them. That always shocked me. You know, I'll say here publicly, this will go to thousands of people. My wife can paint a house, I can't do it. If I paint a house, I'll get more paint on me than on the walls. That's not one of my things. I'm not ashamed. My wife is very good at it. So again, when I got married and I found out, wow, I'm marrying someone who can paint and do these things and fix, I didn't think, ooh, this belittles me. I thought, wow, I'm stronger now. Because alone, I can't do these things. But now together, we can do it better. When we lived in Italy, we redid all the floors. We had relatives there that owned tile company, and they gave us tile. And we redid all the floors, you know. I cut them, and Petra, with a big thing, you know, with the cement, you know, she did the plastering, you know. And we worked together. That's the way it goes. But I'm shocked when I see men that will hold their wives back simply because of their own pride. You know, and that's part of our priestly duty as Yeshua loves the congregation. Do you think he's up there in heaven saying, wow, this guy has all these talents, let me stop him because he might be better than I am? Of course not. He's trying to enhance our talents so that we can bear more fruits for the kingdom. And that's part of our job as the priest of the family. We have to make an environment that helps our wife to be able to have her spiritual gifts to be able to be used better. You know, so again, we should not be threatened, because the stronger the husband is, the stronger the wife is. The stronger the wife is, the stronger the husband, because you're one. You're one. And that's what we have to realize, you know, that if our husband or our wife is not completing the way we think they should be, then complete them. Because when you make them better, you're making yourself better. Genesis 2 and verse 24. Genesis 2 and verse 24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one. Ikad, unified. So again, when you're putting down your spouse, you're putting down yourself. And the better thing to do is, if you can recognize where your spouse is going wrong, then try to change it. Try to help. Let's go to Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31. But today we will not talk about the Proverbs 31 woman. We'll talk about the Proverbs 31 man. You are one in thought, purpose, and love. Your wife's goal should be to complete her husband, and the husband should be to edify, protect, and build spiritual love with his wife and family. The wife's goal should be to complete the husband where he's lacking, and the husband should be to edify, protect, and build the spiritual life of the wife and the family. So Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 in verse 23. It says, her husband is known in the gates when he sits with the elders of the land. So again, she could not have become the Proverbs 31 woman without a Proverbs 31 husband. The same way, like we said, there's never a Jezebel without an Ahab. In the same way here, you don't have a Proverbs 31 wife without a Proverbs 31 husband. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits with the elders. You know, we've all been there. We've been here in Israel. There's city gates. We were at Tel Dan not that long ago. And we see it is an honor for the man to sit in the gate of the city. It's an honor, because what does that mean? It means that he's being recognized as a leader in the community. It means that he's administrating things. It means he's doing work there. He's not sitting there taking pictures. You know, he's working in the gate. He's doing something that's functional there. So it shows that the husband is well respected in the community because he provides for his family spiritually and physically. It doesn't just happen. The man is well respected in the community because he provides for his family spiritually and physically. And then if we go to verse 11 and 12, Proverbs 31, it says, "The heart of her husband trusts her, so that he has no lack of gain. She deals good with him and not evil all the days of her life." So again, the priest has to trust his wife. I forget, it came up in our class, one of the questions that came up. Oh, it was a question that somebody brought up about the thing with adultery. And, you know, if the wife was thought to be in adultery and that you would bring the wedding tokens, you know, they would bring before the elders, and someone brought up, what about the husband? How do you know with the husband? And my answer was, if a woman has no trust for her husband, then why on earth would you marry him to begin with? You know, if there's not trust there, that you're worried, is he doing this, is he doing that, then forget about it. You know, and that's what we see here. The heart of her husband trusts in her so that he has no lack of gain. Trust is foundational. That's why I say it takes years and years and years to build trust and one stupid move to destroy it. But if there's not trust in a relationship, a husband and a wife binding together, you're in trouble. You're in trouble from day one. She deals good with him and not evil all the days of her life. You know, like we said, the years back here, there was a couple that came. I was doing marriage counseling. We had a lot of married couples that year. And the youngest couple, they were only maybe 19, 20 years old. And the woman who wasn't just there yet, she wasn't baptized, she said, "I'm not going, I don't need any counseling. Because the minute he don't listen to me, I just spend all the money in our checkbook." Wow. She deals good with him and not evil all the days of their life. Are women spiteful to their husbands? You know, when you're not getting your way. And you're doing spiteful things, or you're purposely burning the food or whatever else it might be. You know, she deals good with him and not evil all the days of her life. So the men, there has to be the trust. And we have to treat each other good, not evil. Husbands have trust in wife, not envy. Glad at the things the wife does better than he because they're one. And like I said, shame on any man who's jealous of his wife because she can do something that he can't do. Exodus 29, the last number three aspect of a priest. A priest must be under judicial order. A priest must be under judicial order. And there's a lot of men today, I find this very, very interesting. Because we said judicial order, right? It's not a controlling spirit. We went over that in our class. The difference of a controlling spirit and judicial order. Judicial order is always voluntary and reciprocal. You know, it's voluntary and reciprocal. But yet there are many men out there today, covenant believers, that in their personal family, yes, they want to be the priest, and they want to be the leader, and they want to be the caveman-style leadership, you know, pulling the wife by the hair. But when it comes in the congregation, then their answer is, "Oh, I don't follow a man. You know, we're all equal. I don't follow a man." And there's a contradiction there. So in their personal family, they have a controlling spirit, and in the congregation, then they're not under anybody. And to be honest with you, if that's the case, you're not a priest. As we're going to see here, you're not a priest. Because if you're not teaching from the Torah, if you're not sanctified to Yahweh, and if you're not under judicial order, you do not qualify to be a priest of Yahweh. It's that simple. So Exodus 29 in verse 44. And I think maybe where I see the most problems in marriage, they're coming from people that are in this situation. Because you can't counsel a husband who's not under judicial order. He's not going to listen to what you have to say. You know, he'll want nothing to do with it. So it's these Proverbs 18:1 men. You know, the he who separates himself seeks his own desire. The one that they're not under any judicial order in the congregation, they're not under any judicial order in their marriage. So they're filled with pride. They're acting like pure idiots in their families. They're making goofballs of themselves. And then they're controlling to their wife and their kids. They won't let them so much as step outside without saying boo. And then they have no judicial order under anybody. And it's sad, because I've seen many of these kind of situations. And usually, you know, when me and Petra have seen wives under these situations and children, we say, wow, are they going to be high up in the kingdom? Because, I mean, the wives are being so subservient and trying their best because they realize, let me just get through this hell, because at the end of the road, I'm going to be married to Yeshua. You know, but yet the husband is not showing any love. And the husband doesn't want to hear from anybody. And it's sad to see this. So again, without judicial order, you're not a priest of Yahweh. Exodus 29 and verse 44. He says, and I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar, and I will sanctify Aaron and his sons to minister as priests to me. And I will dwell in the midst of the sons of Israel, and I will be Elohim to them. And they shall know that I am Yahweh their Elohim, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and I may dwell in their midst. I am Yahweh their Elohim. I will sanctify Aaron and his sons to minister to me, and I will dwell in the midst of Israel. So literally, Yahweh is dwelling in the midst of Israel through the priesthood that he sanctified. So when somebody is outside of the congregation, when they're outside on their own, Yahweh's not in their midst. You know, clearly he says, I will sanctify Aaron and his sons to minister as priests to me, and I will dwell in the midst of the sons of Israel. I will be Elohim to them. So Yahweh dwells in the midst of the congregation through the judicial order of the leadership. You know, that's his words, not mine. Mark 3. In verse 14, Mark 3 and verse 14, says, and he ordained disciples of 12 that they might be with him, that he might send them to proclaim and to have authority to heal diseases and to cast out demons. So we see that Yeshua did the same thing. Yahweh ordained the Aaronic priesthood in the Old Covenant and dwelt in the midst of Israel through that priesthood. Yeshua ordained 12 apostles in the New Covenant and dwelt in the midst of the congregation through them. Ephesians 2 and verse 19. Ephesians 2 and verse 19. It says, so then, you are no longer strangers and family members living abroad, but you are natives of the same family of the saints and children of the family of Yahweh, being built up on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. That's our foundation. The apostles and the prophets, Yeshua Messiah himself being the cornerstone of the building, in whom all the building being fitted together grows into a holy sanctuary in Yahweh, a set apart sanctuary, sanctified, in whom you are being built together into a dwelling place of Elohim in the Spirit. So again, the foundation of that is through the leadership that Yahweh sets up and he ordains. Ephesians 4, one chapter over, starting in verse 11. And indeed he assigned some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some shepherds and teachers, for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the building up of the body of Messiah, until we all may come to the unity of the faith and of the full knowledge of the Son of Elohim, to a full-grown man, to a measure of the stature of the fullness of Messiah, so that we may no longer be children, being blown and carried away by every wind of false doctrine of men, who through their craftiness are very skillful in deceiving the people. But speaking the truth in love, we may grow up into him in all things, who is the head, the Messiah. It is through him that the whole body is closely framed together and united at all joints according to the gift that is imparted by measure to each member, for the guidance and control of the body, in order to complete the edifying of the body in love. So the same way that when you had Aaron and the priests in the sanctuary, and the Levites were serving them in the sanctuary, could the Levites say, hey, look, we don't need Aaron, we're going to go out and build our own sanctuary and do it ourselves? Of course not. So the same way in the body of Messiah, the same way that Yahweh set up Aaronic priests for him to dwell in their midst, Yeshua sets up 12 apostles which the congregation is built on, and we went over this in our class, 12 who ordained 12, who ordained 12, who ordained 12, and here we are today, you know, the same way, the same way. And if we're being priests in our family, and we're here to serve in the congregation, then we have to serve under the leadership that Yahweh set up. And as we're going to see, there is one example I'm going to show you of a priest who didn't do that, and didn't end up that well. Psalm 110 and verse 4. Psalm 110 and verse 4. Yahweh has sworn and will not repent. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is an order. We know from Hebrews 7, Yeshua is the high priest of that order. But we are all priests in training for that order. So again, when we set ourselves apart from the leadership in the body of Messiah, what are we doing? We're creating a new order. We're creating something that has not been set apart by Yahweh. And like I say, the Torah is the hedge around Yahweh's covenant, and the elders are the hedge around the people. The Torah is the hedge around the covenant, and the elders are the hedge around the people. They're there, like we read here in Ephesians 4. They're there to keep out false doctrine. They're there to protect the people. They're there for the edifying of the body and to bring all of us to the unity of the faith. So when you see men who are claiming to be leaders who are doing the opposite, they're not allowing you to use your spiritual gifts, but they're suppressing you, they're using controlling tactics, you know they're not elders of Yahweh. Elders of Yahweh, he who wants to be greatest among you, let him be your servant. They're serving in the body for the edifying of the body, for the building of the body, for all of us to use our gifts when we come together the way that Yahweh meant it to be. But family leaders must stay under judicial order. If the leader in a family is not under judicial order, he's not the leader in his family. He's doing exactly what Adam did. He's leaving his family and giving prey for Satan to come in. Because what's going to happen? When you don't have the hedge of your leadership and your congregation, what are you doing? You're allowing Satan to come into your garden. And now you have to talk to him face to face. Where when you have the leadership that Yahweh set up, the hedge of protection around the people, then the people are protected from this. You know, you're never going to come into the four walls of Yahweh's congregation and hear that the Sabbath rotates according to the moon. You're never going to hear that Yeshua didn't pre-exist. You're never going to hear the new one now, that Yeshua is Lucifer. That's the new one that's coming out. And all the other nonsense that comes. That nonsense comes when you leave the protection of your priesthood and you go out on your own. And that's why I say the big lesson I learned this year, don't leave the camp. There is protection in the camp. Because those things will never be allowed in the camp, because Yahweh has set leaders in the camp to keep that kind of stuff out. Let's go to Judges 17, because there is one situation of a man, though, that was a priest of Yahweh, but he left the camp. He was a priest of Yahweh and not under judicial order. And let's see what happened in this situation. Judges 17 and verse 1. And there was a man of the hills of Ephraim, and his name was Micha. We drop down to verse 5. And the man Micha had a house of gods, and he made an ephah in household items, and he consecrated one of his sons, and he was a priest him. So what do we have? We have a problem right off the bat here. You know, here's this guy, he consecrates himself, he's making false idols, and then he makes one of his sons to be a priest, who's not even a Levite, you know. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. It's interesting, like I said, whenever you're looking to set a precedent for something that you're doing, please don't go to the book of Judges. This is written here four times in Judges, the same thing. And in those days, there's no king in Israel. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. I've seen women try to go there in Judges 4 about Deborah. Look, women can be leaders. Look at Deborah. Falling into the trap, you know. Judges is to show us what not to do. Judges is to show us what happens when there is no judicial order. It's not something to follow this. You know, a guy who's going out and sending his son as a priest with all household items. And there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite, and he resided there. And the man went out of the city, out of Bethlehem, Judah, to live where he might find a place. And he came to the hills of Ephraim, to the house of Micha, to work his way. And Micha said to him, From where do you come? And he said to him, I am a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I am going to live where I may find a place. And Michal said to him, live with me and be a father and a priest to me. And I will give you 10 silver pieces for the days and an order of garments and your upkeep. And the Levite went in. Here we see, hireling, right? The guy's a hireling, no doubt about it. And the other thing is what happened to Michal's son. He got booted out. So that's another thing when you see people that are outside of judicial order, that seeking their own desire, you know, they'll look for friendship as it benefits them, and then as soon as they don't need you anymore, you're out the window. You know, so we see it's very selfish, it's very prideful, it's very self-serving. And the Levite was willing to live with the man, and the young man was to him as one of his sons. And Michal filled the hand of the Levite, and the young man was a priest to him, and he was in Michal's house. So here it is. Oh, we find a Levite. The Levite is a hireling. So he's willing to go into this. Let's drop down to chapter 18. We'll see what happens here now. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. We see it again. Everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to inhabit. For to that day, it had not fallen to them by inheritance among the tribes of Israel. And the sons of Dan sent out of their family 5 men from their whole number, men, sons of valor, from Zorah and from Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to search it. And they said to him, go, search the land. And they came to the hills of Ephraim, to Michal's house, and lodged there. And they were near the household of Michal, and they recognized the young man's voice, the Levite. And they turned in there and said to him, who has brought you here? And what are you doing in this place? And what have you here? And he said to them, this and this Michal has done to me. And he hired me, and I am a priest to him. You know, so clearly he's a hireling. There's no doubt about that. He admits to that in no uncertain terms. Let's drop down to verse 11. Because now they go back, you know, and they get more people, and they're going to come up to the land of Dan, where we were a few weeks ago. But let's look at the rest of the story here. Verse 11. And 600 men of the family of the Danites from Zorah and from Eshtaol girded themselves with weapons of war. And they went up and camped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore they called that place a camp of Dan until this day. Behold, it is behind Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed on from there to the hills of Ephraim and came into the house of Michal. And the 5 men who had gone in to spy out the land of Laish answered and said to their brothers, do you not know that there are in these houses an ephah and household items and a graven image and a molten image? And now you know what you are to do. And they turned in there and came into the house of the young man, the Levite in Michal's house. And they asked him for peace. And the 600 men of the sons of Dan girded on their weapons of war were standing at the opening of the gate. And the 5 men, those who went to spy out the land, came in there. And they took the graven image and the ephah and the household items and the casted image. And the priest was standing at the opening of the gate and the 600 men who were girded with weapons of war. And when these went into the house of Michal and took the graven image, the ephah and the household items and the casted image, even the priest said to them, what are you doing? And they said to him, be quiet. Lay your hand on your mouth and go with us and be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to one man's house or for you to be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? And the heart of the priest was glad. And he took the ephah and the household items and the graven image, and went among the people. See, you see, the higher link is always going to go where the highest bid comes from. So here's a guy that's a priest, and like I said, you see the same thing today. These people that are not real priests of Yahweh, that are not under judicial order, they're doing the same thing. Today they find this false thing, tomorrow they find something else. Today they're going to come in and say, oh, this guy's a great teacher. Tomorrow they're going to hate him and go to somebody else. They're looking for the highest bidder. They're looking for their own selfish ways. They're looking for things that are fitting their lifestyle. Hey, if you want to divorce your wife and marry another, just search on the internet. Find a congregation that has that, and then you'll join it. This is the Michal syndrome. But it's totally outside of Yahweh's judicial order. And certainly this Levite was not working for Yahweh, but was working for himself. If we drop down to verse 22... They had gone far away from Michal's house, and the men who were in the houses near Michal's house had been called together. And they had overtaken the sons of Dan. And they called the sons of Dan, and they turned their faces and said to Michal, what ails you that you have been called together? So it's like, what ails you? They took everything that's his. They took his priest that he paid. And he said, you have taken my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you are leaving. And what more do I have? What is this you say to me? What ails you? And the sons of Dan said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us, that men bitter in soul not fall on you, and you lose your life and the life of your household. And the sons of Dan went on their way, and Michal saw that they were stronger than he, and he turned and went back to his house. So there he goes. And like I said, so it is with the hireling. You know, when I was in Church of God years ago, the same thing happened. The church fell apart, and what happens? People that were not believing in the changes stayed there for the salary, and then when the new organization came, they wouldn't even tell their congregation what was wrong in order for them to get severance pay. Some of them that I knew personally were actually getting two salaries from two different churches and saying, don't tell the church, though, that I'm preaching here in the afternoon. It's the Miha syndrome. Totally outside of Yahweh's judicial order. In verse 31, and they set up for themselves Miha's graven image, which he had made all the days that the house of Elohim was in Shiloh. If you go to chapter 21, a couple pages over, in verse 25, we read it again. And in those days there was no king in Israel. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. So again, if we're going to be training, if we're going to be a priest to Yahweh and our family, we can't do what's right in our own eyes. We have to be under judicial order. Yahweh had a system set up with Aaron. He had a system through the days of Israel. He had a system set up with Yeshua. He had a system through the early apostles. He had a system through the Paulicians and the Bogomils and the Waldenses and the Insabbatai and the Bavarians and the Puritans and the Pilgrims and the Anabaptists all the way through till today. And it's the same system. So we must stay within judicial order. Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. Priests leaving Elohim-guided judicial order. So like I said, you could find this one example here of a priest that was outside of judicial order, and it was in a very, very bad way. The last scripture I want to go to is Romans 12. Because like I said, as priests of Yahweh, of the Melchizedek order, we're not training how to chop animals apart. We're not training how to sacrifice animals like Levite. But we're training to be Melchizedek priests in the service of Yahweh. Romans 12 says, therefore, brethren, I call on you through the compassions of Elohim to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, pleasing to Elohim, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this age, sanctified, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, in order to prove by you what is the good and pleasing and perfect will of Elohim. So this is what every priest of his family should be seeking, to be a living sacrifice. As priests of our family, we need to be mature and be living sacrifices daily. It is a great responsibility to be a priest before Yahweh, and we cannot take it lightly. We must be teaching our family and making an environment conducive for growth of our family. Remember we said environment is 90% of the battle. So as the priest of the family, the man must make an environment conducive for the growth of his wife and his children. We must be keeping our lives sanctified, set apart from the world, and we must be within Yahweh's ordained judicial order in the congregation if we want to truly fulfill our role as priests. The last thing I will mention very quickly is that it's very interesting also that we know that the Levites is a shadow for Melchizedek. We know that Levite was an afterthought. We know that the whole Levitical order was added beside the Torah until Reformation was come. But if you look up the words for priest, it's a different word from the Levite to the Melchizedek. Not just the word Levite or Melchizedek, but the word priest. When the word priest is used in the first covenant, it literally says the sacred order of the priesthood, because it's a shadow of the Melchizedek. But when you look up the word for priesthood in the new covenant, it literally says a ministry of service. A ministry of service. So also we see that not only is the priesthood itself different, the whole ideology in the job is different. Where yes, as a priesthood that was Levite shadowing the high priest of Yeshua, they had one job. But we know that when Yeshua came, he said, you know, that even though he is the high priest, he said he came as one serving. You know, in John 13, when he did the foot washing. And we know Yeshua also said, he who wants to be greatest among you, let him be your servant. So in the high priesthood of Melchizedek, and in the priesthood of Melchizedek,
What Yahweh is looking for is priests of family that not only are good teachers and not only are keeping their life sanctified and not only are under judicial order, but for true men who are humble and that have a servitude attitude, that are not filled with pride, and are people that Yahweh is going to be able to use when the kingdom comes. So, Yahweh bless. Shabbat shalom. And men, are you fulfilling your priesthood?